Hello, Mr. Zorn.
Hello.
Welcome to WAIF, and you don't do many of these interview things, so we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
We started off the show tonight playing some records by Masada. That's your quartet. It seems to fuse bebop, free jazz, and klezmer a little bit. Tell us a little bit about Masada and what that's all about. That's a big question.
Can you phrase that in a different way?
All right. What's it like playing with these guys? I've heard the record, seen you play. Dave Douglas is a hell of a trumpet player.
He's a great player.
And Joey Barron blows me away every time I hear him on a record.
And Greg Cohen is just as amazing. I mean, it's a really magical band.
Right. Where'd you hook up with those guys? And is klezmer part of the hookup?
Well, maybe we should get something clear right at the start.
Okay.
Which is, klezmer is not synonymous with Jewish music. Jewish music is really a lot broader than just klezmer. And what Masada is trying to do is really create something that's beautiful and positive and looks towards the future. And the influences in the Masada music are as various as the influences that went into the Naked City music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's surf influences there. There's, Arabic influences there. There's influences from thrash metal. There's influences from free jazz. There's influences from classical music. There's influences from, everything that I've listened to is kind of made up, the music that you're listening to there. And it's a very easy cliche to just kind of say, well, kind of mixing free jazz with klezmer. That's really not what's going on there. It's a lot more complicated than that. And if you listen to some of the other records that have been made of that same music, now Masada is Masada as a band, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's more for me a book of compositions. There's like over 200 compositions in the Masada book, and those compositions can be done by any kind of group, I do those pieces with Mark Feldman on violin, Eric Friedlander on cello, and Greg Cohen on bass, just violin, cello, and bass. And then people say, whoa, this is like really in the tradition of Jewish string music. And then I do it with, Mark Rebo on guitar, and then it sounds like more like kind of surf, exotica, easy listening lounge kind of thing. I mean, that stuff, if I did it with a hardcore band, you know what I'm saying?
You've got a double CD out that has something on the liner notes about the Masada chamber music or Masada string chamber music. Is that the same book of compositions?
Exactly. These are 200 compositions that can be interpreted by any group of players.
Well, if a young musician, whether he was a guitar player or a saxophonist or a pianist, wanted to check out these compositions, I don't know if they're in chart form or if they're posted on the internet or anything, where could someone take a look at the scores?
Well, right now the scores are not published. If you want to come up to me after a concert, I'll be glad to give you some charts. Otherwise, the best way to do it is the way I learned a lot of music, which is by listening to it and writing it down off of the record.
And some of the songs that I hear on the Masada records are tonal enough that most people's ears can figure them out.
Yeah, this stuff is meant to be very compact and very direct and very clear. There's a head, then we improvise on the form, and then there's a head at the end. So It should be pretty straightforward.
That's definitely a traditional jazz influence right there.
Absolutely.
And the thrash metal and the surf influences aren't as apparent, at least not on the 10 Masada Quartet CDs.
Well, I mean, you don't hear the surf influences because it's not played by a surf guitar.
The melodies, you can hear it in those a little bit.
Well, when you get those kind of chords that are like dropping down a major second, that's like, going from like, G minor to F minor back and forth, this is very, very much for me coming out of a surf bag. There are a lot of surf bands that kind of came out of that area harmonically. Very simple. The harmonies that I use in the Masada music, it's not advanced jazz harmony. I tried to keep it very simple. And as you know, surf music, most of those players, they could barely play more than three or four chords.
It depends on who you're talking about.
And it's a sound that I really love. It's very, you know, it kind of is very soulful, and it's very accessible to a wide range of people. And I didn't, you know, I really, the jazz influences are clearly there, certainly in the Masada Quartet because of the lineup, sax, trumpet, bass, drums. But again, you know, if I do that music with, you know, two percussion, violin, cello, bass, and guitar, then it begins to sound like something different.
Maybe the answer is that you're keeping it simple, but I was wondering why, when you assembled the Masada Quartet, why you didn't have a harmony instrument in there like a piano or a guitar to sort of fill up the chordal part of the music.
Well, that can sometimes get in the way and restrict what's going on. If you really listen to what's going on in the improvisations, Dave Douglas and I are taking a lot of liberties. We're working modally. We're working with a variety of scales on a variety of chords and pedal points. And at times, it does get into a kind of an Ornette-influenced harmonic area where things will change with pivot notes. We go from one scale to another based on one pivot note, and sometimes we just, you know, jump freely from one scale to another. So, you know, we're trying to take the idea of Jewish music, of Jewish scales, and approach it in a way that it has not been approached before. All of the scales pretty much used in the Masada music are there's basically two Jewish scales. There's the Avaraba, you know, with a flat 2, it's a major scale with a flat 2, and then there's a minor scale with a sharp 4, and that everything is there, and it kind of relates to blues sometimes, and there's kind of a blues scale that you work with, and we go here, we go there, and, you know, Dave is an incredible musician with a harmonic knowledge that's just mind-blowing, and it's really a pleasure to play with him and that whole band. I mean, back to the band, that is a magical band. That is an incredible band.
Let me play another track. I have a shortcut queued up from Masada 6. It's the fifth cut. I think it's called Navala. And there's an interesting interplay between the drums and the bass, especially with Joey Barron. Let me give this a little bit of a spin, and in 2 minutes and 11 seconds when we come back, tell me a little bit about playing with these guys. Can we do that?
Okay.
Okay, hold on just a second.
I'm holding.
Masada, WAIF. From Masada's sixth record, Dave Douglas on trumpet, Greg Cohen on bass, Joey Barron on drums, and John Zorn, the composer, and on saxophone. We're talking to John Zorn on WAIF tonight. I'm Chris Comer. And if you'd like to call in and ask a question I could relay to Mr. Zorn, the phone number is 961-8900. Give it a shot if you'd like. I just played that cut from Masada because of the interesting rhythms that Joey Barron was playing. Where did you find him, and is he one of the most awesome drummers you've ever played with?
Well, that guy is just, I mean, he's on another level. And it's constantly, it amazes me that more people don't appreciate what he's doing. I mean, he rarely places in the downbeat polls. He's never won any kind of award. When people are doing recordings, they rarely call him up to come and do the recordings. He doesn't do that much sideman stuff. I just can't believe it. He absolutely is one of the best drummers on the planet. He's revolutionized the sound of the drums. It's his life. He thinks about it all the time. He's practicing all the time. And every time I play with him, he plays something I've never heard before.
He plays with his hands frequently, too, doesn't he?
His hands, mallets, his head, his feet, anything that he can hit a drum with, he's going
to
hit it.
Well, a lot of guys are afraid to be unconventional, and I know that you come from a school of thought that does what needs to be done in order to make the music happen right.
Well, we try to push things out and try something new. We're not here to celebrate the discoveries of the past. We're trying to, you know, find some new shit. Can I say shit?
You can say anything you want. This is WAIF in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it's 10:30 in Cincinnati.
That sounds great.
Is there anything you want to know about Cincinnati before we continue?
Let's continue.
All right. What about the other guys in the group? Dave Douglas plays trumpet. He turns up on recordings all the time.
Absolutely, he's all over the place now. All over the place. Well, I mean, I met Dave, I guess, in 93. I was working on a soundtrack for a film out of Chicago called Thieves Quartet. And he wanted kind of a, you know, Miles Davis kind of 50s jazz sound to it. So I called Dave, and the hookup was just immediate. I mean, it was just so great to play with him. In fact, the score for that film was the Masada Quartet. Joey, Greg, Dave, and I did that score. And a month later, we started doing Masada music.
Mm-hmm. You guys solo really well together, and a lot of traditional-type jazz groups, I won't say any names, but they're afraid to solo at the same time, or at least the front line will be if you've got a couple of horns or a guitar or whatever. These guys want their space when they solo, and they don't want anybody stepping on it. When you and Dave solo, I hear counterpoint, I hear interplay between each other, melodies are bouncing back and forth, not only melodies from the head, but I'll also hear melodies from the solos that you guys will be picking up from each other, so you must be listening.
Oh, there's a lot of listening in that band, and that's what makes it so much fun.
Why is it that some guys are a little more uptight? Maybe it's just ego, but some guys don't want to give up their 8 bars or their 16 bars and play off with somebody a little bit.
Well, I mean, I can't really address that, I'm afraid. I don't know why. All I can say is that, you know, Dave and I, we love doing solos. We like trading fours and eights, and we like playing together. We're just there to make music, and there's, you know, nothing that gets in the way of that.
And what about Greg Cohen, the bass player in the group? He's the only fellow that I hadn't heard of before picking up the Masada CDs.
Well, you may not have heard his name, but you've probably heard his sound, because he's played with more people than I can even mention. He's all over the place on a lot of pop recordings. He was integral to the Tom Waits sound from the, you know, all the way through the 80s. He's just an incredible musician who does arrangements, orchestral arrangements. He does production for, you know, pop records and vocalists. He does, he's just, you know, I mean, all these guys know everything there is to know about music, and that's what makes it possible for us to go in the directions that we have.
That's pretty cool. There's two live CDs available, one from 94 called Live in Jerusalem, and one from 95 called Live in Taipei. Why did you decide to release those two concerts as live records as opposed to some different concerts?
Well, there was just something very special happening at those times. You know, there's a magic that clicks, you know, just once in a while, everything is just really falls into place. And those were two moments when that happened. You know, what can I say? We just did a concert in Belgium 2 weeks ago, and it was one of those one-offs. We flew over, you know, we took a nap for 2 hours, we went and soundchecked and did the concert. Next morning, we went back to New York, and, you know, we were in Belgium like about 12, 14 hours, something like that. But the music was absolutely incredible. It just, and that's going to come out as the next live CD. It should be out in November, live in Middelheim, Belgium.
I'll give you a couple of props here, and nobody's paying me to do this, but there are a couple of record stores in town that I can generally find most of the John Zorn works in stock. One would be Shake It Records in Northside on Hamilton Avenue, and then, of course, those coffee-swilling bookstores always tend to carry John Zorn's material. Why is it that the coffee-swilling bookstores carry your stuff, but sometimes the hip underground record store still hasn't heard about you?
Well, that's a question. I don't know if I can really answer, but I'm in a very strange position. It's kind of like, you know, I'm too straight for to be, you know, hip in the underground, and I'm too weird and freaked out to be accepted by the mainstream. So I'm really in this weird limbo in between, and what can I say? I'm just trying to make some music, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't even drink coffee.
And you're trying to have a good time doing it and trying to make some music that's meaningful, right?
That's part of the program, yeah.
Well, let me ask you something about the acceptance of an artist, whether you're talking about yourself or somebody mainstream or somebody even further out than you, you know, like one of those European jazz guys. Why is it that it's hard to get good music released on a record label with the cover art that you want to have on it?
Well, it depends on what record label you're talking about. Obviously, I put my own label, Sodic, together so that I could put exactly what I wanted inside and outside of the package. Why is it hard for, say, Warner Brothers, Elektra, for RCA, for Columbia, Sony, to release that kind of music? Because it doesn't make enough money for them.
Well, wasn't it Nonesuch that released the first Naked City record? They made a couple of bucks off that, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, they still owe me quite a couple of bucks for that one, man.
That's what Prince says, too. I don't know.
Well, everybody says it, and because it's the truth.
Yeah.
You know, they think about ripping you off every minute of every day, and they've got it down to a science.
While we're talking about cover artwork, I did get a phone call in online, too, and I'll relay the question to you. And I wanted to ask you about the cover artwork on the Masada records. There's 10 CDs. They came out on DIW, which, tell me if I'm wrong, isn't that a Japanese jazz label?
Yeah.
And you don't realize it if you buy the Masada CD one at a time or one off. You got the first one, you got the fourth one. They don't look the same. But when you put them all next to each other, they sort of make a picture.
Yeah.
Not just on the spines, because if you look on the spines, you'll see a picture of Masada and Israel, but if you put the CD covers on the floor, you get sort of a, I don't know what it's called, it's a cross or something.
Well, those are actually, they were done in sets of, I think there's in threes. I think there's three, three, and three. Those are actually the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Hmm.
Go figure that.
Yeah, I noticed that there's a lot of torn-up scrolls on the album cover artwork, and I assume that they were Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, those are the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Do the segments that you put on the cover artwork have particular meaning pertaining to the music?
No. They were pretty.
Yeah. And my last question regarding the Masada covers are, does the Hebrew spell something that we should be aware of, or should we just go figure it out on our own?
It does spell something, and if I was to say it over the phone, we would probably disappear.
Okay, I got you. Well, not a whole lot of people in Ohio read Hebrew, at least not the crowd I run with, so I'll
Why not? What's the matter with you? Don't you like Jews?
I'll head down to the library and look into it.
Just ask your Jewish friends.
I'll do that. We're talking to John Zorn on WAIF. It's 20 minutes until 11, and we got a phone call in regarding your cover artwork. The question is from Aaron in Northside, and the question goes as follows. What's the connection between your music and the artwork of Hans Bellmer, Francis Bacon, and Man Ray?
Ah, amazing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other cover artwork questions that I could pose to you. There's a Painkiller cover that was controversial, and some Naked City covers that you had to release in Japan. I don't know what the business end of that, or if it's any of my business.
Well, I mean, it's a long, complicated story. I don't know how interesting it is to everybody. Belmer, Man Ray, I mean, these are just some of my favorite artists. And a lot of times, I mean, sometimes I come up with the cover idea at the same time that I'm putting the music together. Sometimes the cover idea comes first and the music comes out of that, kind of inspired by the images of the cover. Sometimes it's the other way around. All I can say is that making CDs is more than just putting music onto a CD and then throwing an image on it. It's a really intense process that's very integral. The packaging and the music are very connected for me, and I work very closely with the designers, just as I work very closely with the musicians that perform the music.
I know that on some of the Naked City records, particularly Torture Garden, there's a photography and cover artwork having to do with S&M, and I believe some Japanese S&M movies. Could you briefly elaborate on some of that and give some of us corn-fed Midwesterners a taste of Japanese S&M?
Well, I can't really do that over the telephone, but
gotcha.
I can tell you that those images and those records came from a certain time in my life where I had a lot of anger and there was a lot of frustration and there was just a lot going on in my life, and that was a very big part of my life. It's not anymore. It's still part of who I am, but it's not something I do every day. And those images are honest and real, and I believe in them, and they belong with the music that they're attached to. And, I mean, S&M, people don't understand what that's all about. I mean, you're not going to understand it until you do it. So my advice to everybody out there is go and do it.
Go get tied up and you have your ass whipped, right?
Why not?
Okay. We're talking to John Zorn on WAIO.
You could have your cock tortured if you wanted to.
You could do anything you want if you know who to go to, right?
Hey.
And you probably have more access to those type of individuals and circumstances
to go to.
on the East Coast than we do in Ohio.
Right on.
When was the last time you came to Cincinnati to visit one of the Cincinnati dominatrixes?
I haven't been to Cincinnati in a long, long time, but you're making it sound very tempting.
Oh, well, come on out. We'll take you to a Reds game and feed you some greasy food.
What happened to the dominatrix? Do you see at the baseball game?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Up until about 6 months ago, she owned the team. So, New York is a theme in a lot of your music, or at least as far as how fast-paced it is sometimes. Are you a Mets fan or a Yankees fan?
I'm not a sports fan.
Why not?
Hello, are you there? Hello? Did you hang up on me?
No, we're right here.
No, I'm not a sports fan.
Why is that? Some musicians are, and some musicians see it as really something rather silly.
I don't think it's silly. I have a friend who is in the air conditioning business, Mo Siegel, and he's got a box seat on right near first base at the Mets at Shea Stadium. I go there usually once a season.
Okay.
See one game. It's beautiful. A lot of great colors. Music is great.
We got another call-in on the telephone regarding your group, Painkiller. So before I ask you the question,
yeah,
let's play a brief cut by Painkiller that sounds like this. From 1991, obviously you were more angry back then, weren't you?
There was something going on, and let's just say I can't do that anymore.
Well, you know, from a fan's perspective, you know, the Masada CDs have come out since Naked City and Painkiller, and they don't sound as angry. The solos get very intense, but they don't have that angst to them that Painkiller did.
Absolutely. Well, again, you know, everything that I do draws from my own life experience, and what I was feeling back then is very clear in that music, and I just don't feel it anymore. I'm not there anymore. I'm not that, you know, I'm not in that space. I'm in a different place. I've learned, you know, other shit, and I moved on.
Without getting terribly personal, I imagine that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, it's about growing up. I guess eventually we got to do it.
That cut came from the CD called Guts of a Virgin by Painkiller, with Bill Laswell on bass, Mick Harris on drums, yourself on the saxophone and vocals. And there was some controversy with the cover artwork for that record when it came out. The version of the record I have says the original photographs intended for use on this sleeve were seized upon entry into the United Kingdom by Her Majesty's Customs and Excise and were destroyed for allegedly contravening the Obscene Publications Act. Could you elaborate?
That's what happened. Well, they'd been actually opening my mail for a while, checking on what was going on back and forth for a variety of reasons, which I can't go into. But when they found the original photographs, which were L.A. police photos of a woman with a child who'd been sliced up the middle, it's pretty intense. But the amazing thing about the photo...
Where'd you get that picture?
I got a big collection here.
Oh, cool.
The amazing thing about that photo is the incredible peaceful look on the woman's face at the same time as having this incredibly violent thing happening to her body. Now, that's one thing I want to make clear with a lot of the photos that I've used that are relatively violent, is there's a lot more going on in those photos than what people think or what first meets the eye. There's always a dichotomy, a tension and a release, you know, a good and evil, a black and white, a pain and pleasure going on in these photos, and that's why I'm attracted to them. That's why I use them. They're more than just one thing. There's several layers going on here. So this photo was sent to Earache Records in Britain, and it was seized, and they freaked out, and then they raided the Earache office. They confiscated all of my Torture Garden CDs and posters, along with some things by Carcass, the band Carcass, that Bill Steer had put together, the old guitarist from Napalm Death. And there was a long period where I couldn't even go back into Britain.
Really?
Yeah.
Sounds like Paul McCartney trying to get into Japan.
I don't do drugs either, man.
Well, what is it about people, and by people I mean sort of the mainstream that's too uptight, whether you've got pictures of S&M photography or whether you want to smoke a green leafy natural substance, why are some people so uptight that they get in the other people's space? And it reflects on music by people like you because the record labels don't always pick it up.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can probably answer that question.
I could, but I'm asking you. You're the guy.
Well, I want to hear what you've got to say.
I think people are just way too uptight. And if you ever come out to the Midwest, it's even worse here.
Yeah. Well, there is this whole kind of conservative backlash, this kind of politically correct agenda, this PC politics that have really taken over, and they're almost like the new fascists. Each one has a different agenda, and each one has a platform that they're trying to put out there, and a lot of times they go so far that, they become complete hypocrites, and they become break their own rules.
Well, do you think that speed metal and video games and album cover artwork will cause youngsters to go to school with guns?
Are you really asking me that question?
Yeah, I'm really.
No,
yeah, what's
I'm
your opinion on the whole thing?
I don't think that, no.
What about backward masking?
It depends on what's being said.
Well, you remember a few years ago there was that whole Judas Priest thing out in Nevada, and they actually had to cut their hair and go testify.
That's unbelievable.
Nothing like that's ever happened to you, has it?
Well, I've been relatively lucky because I keep a low profile. You got to remember, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm really glad you're a fan of this music, but this is relatively fringe stuff. You know, this is not being bought by millions of people or seen by millions.
No, but there was a time when all the skateboard kids were listening to Naked City.
I'm not so sure about that. I can tell you from the record sales, it wasn't that much. Maybe they were trading tapes.
I saw a kid with a skateboard back in 1992 that had a Naked City sticker on it.
Well, you know, that's hardly a representation of all the skater kids living in the
city. I guess you're right. That was just the one cool one, right?
As well as one cool one. That's my nephew was doing it.
We're talking to John Zorn on WAIF. I'm Chris Comer, and if you'd like to ask a question that I could relay to Mr. Zorn, give us a call at 961-8900. We'll keep Mr. Zorn as long as he's patient enough to do it. And I want to ask you about the following record. I'll play a little bit of it, and then maybe perhaps get a comment from you. This is Haras with William Parker and Derek Bailey.
Oh, yeah, great.
You're listening to Haras with John Zorn improvising on saxophone, Derek Bailey on guitar, and William Parker on the bass. The tune appears to be improvised. Is that true, Mr. Zorn?
That whole record is completely improvised.
Tell me a little bit. I think it's 4 or 5 years old. It says 1995 on the back of the disc. Haras. What is a haras?
You have
Morning Haras.
Derek picked that title.
Did he?
Yeah.
Who is Derek Bailey? A lot of people haven't heard of him.
Well, Derek Bailey is a godfather, I think, to a lot of the people in the downtown scene. He was a guitar player who worked in Britain in the late 50s, playing, hotel gigs and stuff.
Really?
Burt Whedon was one of his favorite players, if you know Burt Whedon. He was kind of like an early Shadows kind of player.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in the mid-60s, early mid-60s, 63, 4, 5, around there, he started improvising in a completely different way with people like Evan Parker and Hon Bennink. It didn't really relate to jazz. It didn't really relate to classical. It didn't really relate to rock. It was just something completely different, and he tried to, at that time, I guess they were calling it non-idiomatic free improvisation, which... Well, it did not refer to any idioms that we may know.
There was a lot of unusual music coming out of Europe in the 60s and 70s that Americans still haven't figured out.
There's a lot coming out now that people haven't figured out.
Yeah. Well, so Derek Bailey was one of those guys back in the 60s.
And he's still one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
He created an entire new language on the guitar, along with a whole set of new techniques of using harmonics and bent notes, in combination with regular plucked notes. And it's really quite astounding what he's done, and he continues to work with new people and just expand his language every time he plays. He's a real master.
How did you wind up getting hooked up with him for the recording of this record and William Parker, who's known for being a somewhat traditional bass player? But
in the free jazz scene, yeah.
Yeah, but not traditional, but you know what I'm saying.
Of course. He's a wonderful player. He's a good friend. And we both had worked with Derek over the past 20 years here and there. I was first called by Derek in 1979 to go on tour with him in Britain.
Hmm.
And William, I think, hooked up with him just very soon after that. And we'd never really done a trio before, so Derek said, hey, let's do this. And we did it, and he was so happy that it came out as a recording.
We got a phone call in. This question is somewhat interesting to me, so I'm going to pass it along. This is from Barton Clifton, and the question is worded I don't care for the wording. Why, when you use vocals, do you use mostly non-lyrical stuff instead of lyrics or words? Don't lyrics interest you? Maybe Bart isn't completely familiar with all of your work, but there is a stereotype of you and Yamatsuka Ai screaming your ass off.
Yeah, well, you know, the voice can be a very expressive instrument, and sometimes words get in the way. It's not that I'm against words or that I have any problems with them. It's just I like to take things one step at a time, and I'm just getting to the point where I think I can put words to music.
What kind of things do you think you might work on if you do start again getting involved with poets or singers?
Well, it'll probably be in a straight classical scene, more like classical chamber music. At this point, I'm thinking of putting some of the haiku of Santoka, who's a early 20th century Japanese poet who wrote a haiku and tanga, putting some of his lyrics to music in a classical, maybe just piano and voice, something like that.
Do you have or have you ever had a university affiliation?
You mean, have I taught at a university? Or?
Well, a lot of guys who do what you're describing, classical music or Western art music or whatever you want to call it, you write string quartets.
Well,
and
yeah.
Kronos has done your string
concerto,
quartet.
I'm working on a violin concerto now.
Yeah, how do the academic guys handle your music?
What's that?
How do the academic guys and the professors and so forth handle your music?
Well, I mean, there's ones that respect it and really appreciate what's going on and other ones that don't. It's just like anywhere else. I mean, I definitely paid my dues in that scene. Classical music was some of the first music that I was really involved in. I've been writing it since I was like, 8, 9, 10 years old, like that. So it's pretty natural. I studied it with a variety of people. I went to college for about a year and then dropped out.
Where'd you go?
Webster College in St. Louis.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have figured you would have said someplace in New York.
I wanted to get the hell away from my parents.
Okay. And so you experienced dorm life and beer bongs, right?
No, I didn't do that.
You went down to the football game on
Sunday. Late night movies and practicing all the time.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering, Frank Zappa used to complain that because he was a rock and roll guy and played guitar that the academic scene wouldn't take him seriously. Do you have that feeling as well?
I wouldn't say that the academic scene has a harder time figuring out what I'm doing any more so than the rock scene or the improv scene or the jazz scene or any scene that I've, you know, kind of touched upon. What I do is really kind of unique, and it draws upon a variety of different influences, but it doesn't really come from any one specific place. Sometimes some of the work seems a little more classical than others. Sometimes it seems a little more jazzy. Sometimes it seems a little more rocky. But ultimately, it's kind of a freak. I really think of it as attached to an avant-garde tradition of really experimental music. So, you know, sure, there's academics that have a problem, but I don't have a problem because I do what I want with the people that, you know, that I like to work with, and they respect what I'm doing. And, you know, I've managed to put together a community, a pool of people that's really supportive, you know? So I've got that support system. I don't need credibility. I don't need Pierre Boulez to call me up and say, I like your work.
And you also
say, hey, that's great, but I don't need that.
You also don't need to find graduate students to perform your work because you seem to be having some of the world's finest already performing your music for you.
Well, I've been really lucky, you know, in the variety of scenes that I've worked in, you know, I mean, out of the jazz scene, I mean, I've worked with some of the best there is. Bill Frisell, you know, I mean, Derek Bailey, Joey Barron, Dave Douglas, you know, out of the classical scene, I've worked with the Kronos, Stephen Drury, the New York Philharmonic has done my stuff, the American Composers Orchestra. I've worked with a lot of great film composers and doing soundtracks. You know, I mean, rock people, man, I worked with some of the cats in Napalm Death,
mm-hmm.
Mike Patton and the guys in Mr. Bungle, I'm really close with them. So, you know, I find I'm doing all right.
We're talking to John Zorn on WAIF. It's a couple minutes until 11 o'clock in Cincinnati, Ohio. Stay tuned for more. I want to ask you about some more music. Do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, I take it you're having a good time tonight.
I'm having a ball, baby.
Okay. We can still take some more calls.
If I can just get unhandcuffed from the radiator, I'll be fine.
We're taking calls, not on the air, but if you'd like to relay a question, I'll relay it to Mr. Zorn at 961-8900. We were just talking about different people you've collaborated. Is there anyone you haven't worked with that you're dying to either play, improvise, or compose some music for?
See, I don't think in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very practical kind of person. And, you know, I work with the materials I have at hand. So I don't really have any dream list of people I'm really dying to work with. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think like that.
That's okay. I asked Adrian Ballou that question once, and he said the Beatles.
The Beatles.
The Beatles.
I like my answer much better.
I don't want to play too much Drop the Needle with you, but I have another piece I want to ask you about. This is called Redbird, and it sounds like this. Redbird, a composition by John Zorn, performed here with a harp, a viola, a cello, and percussion. Jim Pugliese, am I saying his name right?
Pugliese.
Eric Friedlander on cello, Jill Jaffe on viola, and Carol Emanuel on harp. On the inside of the CD, there's what appears to be a handwritten score. Is that what the score looks like?
That's half of it.
Okay. And what is Redbird? Obviously, it's mellow, it's relaxed. You could chill out to this record, burn a couple of candles, and it doesn't seem to resolve. I don't know if there's serialism going on here or not.
It's a series of chords that are put into like every possible permutation of orderings, and it goes on and on. I just wanted to create something that was very minimal and hypnotic, that was a really beautiful mood, and it's inspired by the work of Agnes Martin, and she has a beautiful drawing called Redbird that's in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art here that I used to go and look at when I was like 16, 17 years old. So,
visual.
There's an example of what we're talking about, the artwork before. It's like there's a piece, you know, a piece of artwork that inspired that music.
Your music, is there either a movie or a video in your head or that you're hoping that will be in the theater of the imagination of the listener that would accompany the music?
Yeah, I think that, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's always some kind of extra musical subtext going on, I would say, in all of my work.
Well, with the string quartet, Cat of Nine Tails, it was originally subtitled and tell me if I'm wrong, something about Tex Avery meets the Marquis de Sade.
Yeah, that's right.
What kind of a movie's going on there, and is it rated X? Can we take the kids to see that one?
Well, I mean, that's a fun piece. That's a cartoon piece that also has, you know, the beginnings and the seeds of the beginning of my kind of S&M period.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a variety of things going on there. Again, we're talking about tension and relief, you know, dark and light, evil and good, and it's put together in a kind of a way that flows and tells a kind of a narrative. But I wouldn't want to tell you what narrative I see. I want everyone to find their own narrative.
We took a phone call a minute ago from an individual who wasn't that familiar with your music but was being turned on tonight, wanted to know where he could find more information on your records. And off the air, we directed them to tzadik.com.
That's a great idea.
Spelled T-Z-A-D-I-K.com.
Yeah.
And I've also found as a resource for unusual music the Downtown Music Gallery, which
absolutely
is dtmggallery.com or dtmgallery.com. How's your relationship with Bruce these days?
Oh, I was just over there yesterday picking up his new newsletter.
Oh, yeah?
He's the greatest.
Bruce is a guy that runs this Downtown Music Gallery, and I've been to it once or twice. It's a little record store in New York, about the size of the radio station, actually. It's not very big, but he's got a lot of stuff jam-packed in there.
Oh, he's great. He's been a supporter of this music from the beginning, really, from 79, and he's just got the biggest heart you can imagine.
And he's also able to get a lot of records, not only by yourself and other guys from New York that are hard to find, but in all genres, it seems. He can find obscure European jazz records and even that old Tommy Two-Tone record that your grandma threw away when you were 12. He seems to have it all, so check out Downtown Music Gallery on the internet to hook up with him. Is there anybody else we should give props to tonight?
Well, anybody out there that's running a record store that's not part of the Tower HMV Virgin, nightmare, keep going, man. We are going to win in the end.
They're
not going to make us go away.
We're talking to John Zorn on WAIF. I'm Chris Comer, and we're going to be playing John's music until midnight, but I probably won't keep him that long. There's a couple of extended pieces I want to play, and let's jump into the first one here. It's about a half an hour long, and it's called Memento Mori. It's a string quartet on your new CD that has all four.
What time is it, Chris? Chris?
6 minutes after 11.
If we play that, I probably won't be able to come back. Do you want to play something short off of The Dead Man and then come back again?
Yeah, the tunes off The Dead Man are all 30 seconds long.
Yeah, play a couple of those and then talk to me again. And, because if you play this long thing, I'm not going to hang on the phone for a half hour.
Well, we were hoping you'd stay on hold there with the catheter up your ass.
I'll be asleep. I got to get up at 6 a.m., take my mom to the hospital.
Okay. Let's grab a couple of movements of this. I just sort of picked these at random. Here we go.
Thank you.
That was the last three movements of The Dead Man, the Nocturne, the Etude, and the Prelude. John, why'd you end with a prelude?
Just trying to fuck with people.
I got you. The Dead Man, a string quartet by John Zorn. That was written in 1990. And why'd you just put out a CD featuring four of your string quartets? There's five that I'm aware of.
There is one more. How did you know that?
It was on Spillane, right?
Oh, that piece.
Yeah, am I wrong?
The pieces on this CD are just straight string quartets, no other instruments. The one on Spillane has voice and turntable.
It's called Forbidden Fruit, and it's on the Electra Nonesuch record. Spillane came out in, 87?
Yeah.
Featuring Kronos Quartet, Christian Marclay, and Ota Hiromi.
Yeah.
Did I butcher her name?
No, you did a beautiful job, man.
How did you get along with the Kronos Quartet working with those guys?
Really well. They really wanted to do the music right, and they're very detailed and very meticulous, and they worked incredibly hard. It was really a learning experience for me.
I've always found that string quartets, to me, this is to my perception, not anybody else's, are a very pure form of composition. I mean, you're going to have two violins, a cello, and a viola, whether you like it or not, and those instruments have a lot of opportunity, and they also are limited. And as far as I know, in the history of string quartets, there's not a lot of variations. 200 years ago, they might have added another viola, but they didn't really do much more than that. Do you find that string quartets is a pure way of writing, as opposed to writing for, you know, whatever, a harp and a saxophone and a turntable and a screaming Japanese lady?
Well, you know, it's a challenge, and it does have limitations, but I personally think limitations are really good. I think it's important to have those because it makes your thinking patterns go. It helps your juices going. It helps focus you. So I like problem solving. I think of composition as really problem solving, and to approach the string quartet, a medium that has been around for several hundred years, in a new way, is definitely not easy to do. So it was exciting and it was fun. And it was overwhelming and scary, but ultimately it was a very important thing for me to attack. And I felt like these four quartets really worked well as kind of a set, and it makes a nice CD. It kind of really has a certain flow to it.
With the Cat of Nine Tails, The Dead Man, Memento Mori, and Kol Nidre. What is Kol Nidre? That's the string quartet from 1996, and it's only a brief 8 minutes long.
Yeah, you know, that's began life as a Masada tune.
Oh, yeah?
It's
very pretty.
It's a beautiful thing, and I've never written anything like it, and I probably never will write anything like it again. It's just its own little thing, and I try to make each piece I do, you know, a little bit different and a little special, so it's a beautiful thing.
Do you find that the compositional process is, you mentioned it's problem solving, do you see the compositional process as a game, like your game pieces from the 80s that you're famous for, Archery and Cobra and that?
Well, no, because those games those games are for a variety of people to play. Composition, you sit alone and you solve, you know, you solve the things by yourself. You don't really ask people for input when you're sitting writing a piece from beginning to end. It's got to be your vision. It's got to be your creativity. So it's less like that kind of game and more like code breaking or mathematics or going on a little imaginary trip. An adventure, like going down the Nile or something. You turn to the left, you turn to the right. You never know what you're going to fall into, quicksand, or you're going to discover 200 ancient Egyptian mummies.
You might get devoured by a crocodile too.
And that happens too. Yeah. That happened in Dead Man.
Why? Because they're all real short and they all sound squeaky.
No, you didn't get it. It's in the middle. It's in the middle.
Oh, okay. Because you do use your string quartet in a very screechy, almost like creaky door opening sort of way.
It can be. Sometimes I go for those sounds, and sometimes I don't. And Kol Nidre, obviously an example where I don't do that. The Dead Man was more about using sound and noises. And in between, the Memento Mori piece was a way of trying to incorporate the screechy sounds and the noises with more melodic and lyrical and romantic sounds.
I want to give some props to a local group here in Cincinnati that call themselves the Cobra Ensemble. Have you heard of them?
I have. I have a bone to pick with them.
Oh, you do? Well, feel free to air
it
here. Well, we'd like you to air it here, but before we get to airing your bone, describe for the people who haven't seen a Cobra piece performed or any of your game pieces, what's the game? I see these guys wearing hats, wearing scarves, pointing at each other, making funny faces, doing backflips, and, you know, playing all kinds of music, avant-garde and cheesy stuff. What's going on in the game pieces?
Well, the game pieces, I guess, ultimately, I compose for players, for musicians. That's what I'm writing music for. And I write for, like I said, you know, I don't write for people that I don't know or for, you know, Metropolitan Opera stage performances. I write for the material and the people I have at hand. The game pieces were a way of harnessing the improvising musicians that I had been working with for 10 years in compositional format. And what I devised was a very complicated series of on-off switches. Basically, I talk about when people can and can't play in very complicated ways, but I never tell them what they should play.
Mm.
And it's structured in such a way that everybody has equal control over the group. At any time, people can say, hey, let's go here. And you're there until someone decides, well, let's go here.
And that's what the hats and the scarves are all about.
Well, those hats and the scarves are ways of departing from the rules of the piece so that you have kind of the ability to play whatever you want, whenever you want, ignore the rules, and you can also affect certain players in the group. I mean, this is a long conversation. These rules are kind of like the rules of baseball. You know, I can't really tell you how to play baseball in 30 seconds. It's not as simple as just, you know, well, there are two teams, and you're trying to get as many, you know, runs as possible, and you hit a ball, and three strikes, and you're out. It's a little more complicated than that.
And if the bass player is going to make a wager that the saxophone player won't finish the piece, will he get kicked out of the Hall of Fame?
No, he'll have to do backflip.
Okay, I got you. Well, so what's the bone you want to pick with the local Cobra Ensemble?
Well, it's not really a bone. I've actually talked to them about it. Cobra is a strange phenomenon. The more people do it, the sicker they get. It's almost like a disease. It's like a fever.
Why? Because they just keep wearing their hats all the time?
They wrote the piece themselves, and they begin to create new rules. It's kind of like, you know, playing Monopoly. There were Queens rules, and then there were Manhattan rules, and there were Brooklyn rules. It's like Monopoly can be a different game depending on where you're playing it, you know? And Cobra is not just a game. It's a composition that I created, and it needs to be played correctly. And people should not be doing backflips. It's not an opportunity for people to masturbate on stage. It's meant for 12 musicians to get together who are trying to make some music, to work together as a band and create something beautiful, you know? And a lot of times people look at the scores for the game pieces and they figure, oh, man, this is great. Now I can finally, you know, get on stage and pull my pants down and take a dump in somebody's hat. And that's, you know, not what those pieces are meant.
I hadn't heard about that.
No, sorry, man. But anyway...
Well, if you ever get a chance to come to Cincinnati and those guys are playing a gig, you should go see them. They are fun to watch.
Great.
And, hey, they're having fun, and life is good. If you're writing the original piece for Mark Ribot and Arto Lindsay, and then, you know, a bunch of people in Cincinnati are doing it, do you think they're missing the point?
Not at all. Not if they play it by the rules and are serious. It's for anybody. It's not. These things are for anybody. And, actually, these game pieces are being performed all over the world on a regular basis, every month in Tokyo, in Germany, in Finland. In Australia.
Yeah, they have Cobra festivals at the Knitting Factory, don't they?
Well, I stopped them because I don't want to work with those rat bastards anymore. But the piece, it really has a life. It's being taught in schools. It's a way of introducing improvisation to people who don't know how to improvise. It's a lot of fun to watch, but again, it is a game, and you got to play by the rules. You know, you need an umpire there, maybe, you know, and a doctor, and a psychiatrist.
We were talking about the academic...
And a dominatrix.
Oh, hell yeah. We were talking about the academic situation a while ago. How do you feel about schools teaching Cobra and some of your other game
pieces? Great, why not? I mean, you know, you put music out there, it's meant to be spread around. Like, a lot of musicians get upset about bootleg tapes and, you know, such things. Don't bother me at all. Music is there to be used. I want it out there. I want people to hear it. And whatever they want to do with it up to a point is cool. But if they're going to perform my music, I want them to do it seriously and try to get it right.
How do you feel about bootlegs?
They're fine.
You like bootlegs?
Yeah, man. Go ahead. Do it, baby.
Do you let people come to your shows and do, like, the Grateful Dead and set up their...
Well, it's not as intense as the Grateful Dead, but there's a lot of people that are taping my shows, and my feeling is if they're into the music and they're sharing the stuff, why not?
So you're saying that if I came to your show and had a big old microphone sticking out of my pants, I'd be cool with you?
Well, if it was sticking out of your pants, that'd be all right. But if you put it in my face, that may not be all right.
Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to us tonight, John Zorn. I know you don't do many of these, and it was a pleasure having you on the show.
It's an honor to be on your show, man.
And before we let you go, give us a little introduction to Memento Mori. It's a half an hour long, and we're going to play the whole damn thing.
Well, it's a very emotional, kind of hermetic piece.
It's one of the string quartets.
It's very hard. It's a difficult piece, but I really believe in it. I think I've struck on something new with that piece, and there's something magical going on. And it's not easy to get through. It's difficult going, but I think it's worth the rewards of several listenings. There's some beautiful moments, and there's a really unusual form going on, and every note in the piece relates in some way to Alban Berg's lyric suite.
Really? So is there a 12-tone technique going on with Memento Mori?
Oh, well, in addition to a lot of other techniques.
Really?
In addition to a lot of other techniques.
So it's both hard to play and hard to listen to?
And hard to analyze. It's really hard to play, I can tell you that. But these guys really did a beautiful job. It's gorgeously played by this group. And,
the group is called the John Zorn Quartet, right?
Well, yeah, right. I couldn't think of... They didn't want to think of a name. I don't know.
Joyce Hamann on violin, Mark Feldman on violin, Lois Martin on viola, and Eric Friedlander on cello.
They're the cats.
You want to give them some more props? Do they have any other gigs coming up?
They're going to be doing a record of Mark Feldman's string quartets that should be out, I think, on Enja in about 3 months.
A little off the subject, but I used to really enjoy Elliot Sharp's Digital.
Oh, that's great.
That's a nice piece.
He lives right upstairs. I'll tell him you said that.
Tell him that. I used to like how it popped. It sounded
very
digital. I
still like it.
Well, yeah. It's old news now, but it's a great piece.
Yay.
All right. Thank you, John Zorn, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay, man.
Have a good evening.
You too.